Hi, my name is Mandy Jackson Beverly, and I'm a bibliophile. Welcome to the Bookshop Podcast. Each week, I present interviews with independent bookshop owners from around the globe, authors, and specialists in subjects dear to my heart, the environment and social justice. To help the show reach more people, please share it with friends and family and on social media. And remember to subscribe and leave a review wherever you listen to this podcast. You're listening to episode 201. Lighthouse Books, located at West Nicholson Street, Edinburgh, is a queer-owned and woman-led independent community bookshop. The store is an unapologetically activist, intersectional, feminist, anti-racist, LGBTQ+ community space, celebrating diversity of thought and expression, championing voices from the margins. Lighthouse Books is committed to playing their part in building a greener, fairer, kinder tomorrow. In practice, this means they are a living wage and inclusive employer. They honor an engaged and evolving safe spaces policy, a commitment to accessibility, high environmental and sustainability standards, and curation led by content, seeking out own voice narratives and diverse writing so that their shelves and sales reflect their values. Lighthouse Books also values their strong commitment to independent presses nurturing such talent. Hi, Mari, and welcome to the show. It's lovely to have you here all the way from Edinburgh.
Oh, thank you for having me, Mandy. It's really exciting to be talking about bookshops with you.
Yes, we can talk about books, bookshops, Edinburgh, but I had to laugh when I went to your website. There was a blog post titled Cute and Rad, where Schitt's Creek and anti-fascism rubbed shoulders. So who came up with that fabulous headline?
Well, it really was just one morning I was taking pictures in the shop and looked at one of the tables and were like, this is so us, that this is just how the books have been put on the table. And so sometimes we try and be a little bit deliberate. So we might pick a particular theme, or we might be like, all right, this is all just the new stuff. And then we do that sort of feminist audit where we make sure that there's a good gender balance and there's, but generally it's just whatever happens to be on the table. And then that was, and it, they just look so pretty in pink, the two of them. And it was, like, yeah, actually, this is how we get people to pick up and engage with radical ideas, is that it shouldn't be in a back corner or tucked away somewhere that feels inaccessible or scary. It's just, you should be as interested in Schitt's Creek and anti-fascism.
And who doesn't love Schitt's Creek? I mean, it's fabulous. Okay, so let's talk about you. I understand you spent time in my home country of Australia. What led you there and what brought you back to Scotland?
So despite the accent, my family is from Scotland. So my mum's from Kilmarnock and my dad's from Lockerbie. And so my roots are here, but I'd grown up abroad my whole life. And then I came back to Scotland for university and then I left again. And I was working for a human rights firm in Mumbai in India. And that was when I sort of figured out that having done my law degree, having decided this was how I was going to make my contribution in the world, that I have the emotional stamina of a flea. And in the heat of both the landscape of human rights and the literal heat, I'm very, for listeners, I'm very ginger. I'm very pale and I just melted in every way. And I'd always wanted to do books and I'd volunteered in charity bookshops. And so rather than come back to the UK and admit defeat, I ran away. And I was already halfway to Australia at that point. And I had a cousin out there and I had just enough money to go over and try my luck at something else. And so when I arrived, I applied to every bookshop in Sydney and all of them said, no, thank you.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, I think the Aussies, they take their bookselling really seriously. And there was the sense that I didn't have sufficient experience. And so I did a lot of bartending and bits and pieces until eventually a bookshop hired me to manage the bar in the bookshop. So Berkelow Books in Paddington was just opening a coffee shop bar inside the bookshop. And so I got to do that. And then I was really lucky. Jay Lansdowne, who runs the Constant Reader in Sydney's North Shore, took a punt on me and gave me a job as a bookseller. He actually hired someone else first, and then that person didn't work out. So I got a call a week after I'd been rejected to say, actually, we'll take you on probation. And the rest is history. Just fell in love with books, fell in love with the bookselling that he was doing, with children's bookselling specifically, just that thing of being able to, you know, kids don't filter those emotions when you get the right book in their hands. They really do just light up. So I ended up doing that. And then eventually my dad was like, oh, getting old. And he sort of faked being to work. I mean, this is 15 years later and he's absolutely fine. He convinced me to come back to Scotland. And so that's how I ended up back here.
And are you happy back in Edinburgh?
I am. Edinburgh specifically is such a phenomenal literary city, and it's such a great place to be. I also think, you know, the politics and the landscape in Scotland is pretty exciting and interesting and full of exciting and interesting characters. So I feel, you know, coming up on it'll be 6 years of having the shop next week. And I feel like it feels like the roots are there. Yeah. So happy, very happy.
Well, it's great that you've had so many interesting life experiences through travel, living in another country. And you've gone from lawyer to bartender to bookseller to bookshop owner. I'm all for encouraging people to go and live in another country, not just to explore it on vacation. I think living in other countries helps to broaden our moral and empathetic compass by introducing us to issues about social justice, diversity, and inclusion, which happen to be a lot of the subjects you promote in your bookshop. Now, when you considered opening an indie bookshop, what drew you to specializing in left-leaning, socially conscious, and feminine books?
So I took over an existing left-leaning feminist shop. So I'd come back to Scotland and I worked in a few of the sort of well-known bookshops of Scotland, including the Golden Hare Bookshop, which was quite a bijou art gallery style. They've got a great selection, but it was aimed at a very particular market. And then I worked at Topping & Company Booksellers, which is a family-run bookshop with thousands and thousands of titles. And then I was working for Robert Topping when Elaine Henry, who used to run the Word Power Bookshop in Edinburgh, decided to retire. And she reached out, not just to me, but put the bookshop on sale and reached out to some people who she thought would continue the bookshop in the vein that it had been established over 23 years. So it had deep roots. It had survived a few things, including Amazon and the 2008 financial crash. And, you know, it was well rooted in its community and it knew what it was doing. But she'd put in her time and she was ready to retire, ready for something new. And I had repeatedly over the years applied to work there and she had never given me a job.
Oh my goodness.
So finally, I took the leap. I sort of felt like I'd been in books at that point, doing stuff with books for about a decade. I knew I had a way of bookselling and a sense of how books for me are part of how we make the world a better place. And therefore, the mission spoke to me, the need, you know, when I thought about it closing or not being a radical bookshop in Edinburgh, it broke my heart. It just felt like at this particular moment in time, it would be so tragic if that happened. So it found me. I don't know that I would have had the courage to start that from scratch. And I really admire those who are doing that. I think there's a boom in radical bookshops across the UK right now, and I have so much respect for the people who just go ahead and do it. I was lucky. Those roots were already there. They were big shoes to fill and big expectations, and it's taken a while to sort of make it my own. But for me, it just sort of, it landed there. And so it meant I could take a risk at exactly the point in time people were saying, oh, it's too niche, and, you know, you're going to alienate people, and you're going to, you know, you couldn't possibly sell just one kind of book or one kind of politics. And I got to say, well, Elaine's been doing it for 23 years. So, you know, now is time to do that and then inject the stuff that I'm passionate about.
I'm interested in what you said about there being a boom in radical bookshops. A couple of years ago, I interviewed Ross Bradshaw, the owner of Five Leaves Bookshop and Five Leaves Publishing in Nottingham. Do you know Ross?
Yes, I do know Ross.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure if you have a radical bookshop anywhere in the world, you know Ross. He's a sweetheart. And he shared with me the history of radical bookshops in England. Do you know much about the history of radical bookshops in Scotland?
There is less of a history. I mean, we're a smaller country, which is part of it. Ross is a sweetheart. And I think in that vein, Ross with Five Leaves and a few of the others in the Alliance of Radical Booksellers that he's behind, you know, they, over the years, he has been such a support and somebody that I've been able to call when I've said, you know, well, this has come up and I just don't know how to go about it, or how would you approach this? And so that those bonds of the radical bookseller and that idea of not being in competition with each other is something that runs very deep and is very supportive and beautiful. So go Ross. And I loved the episode that you did with him. He's just wonderful. And his team are great. I think Scotland has, in Edinburgh specifically, there was at a similar time that it happened in England around the 80s. There was a little mid to late 80s. There was a boom in so-called radical or political bookshops. So Edinburgh got the 1st of May bookshop, which was a workers' bookshop, Women's Zone, which was a feminist bookshop, and Lavender Menace, which was an LGBT bookshop. And they all opened in the 80s. Only Lavender Menace lasted well into the 90s. But the others closed. And in a way, Word Power, the predecessor to Lighthouse that opened in 94, was a way of bringing the feminist, the worker, and the LGBT under one roof and sort of creating a space where those marginalized communities lived under one roof. And also where a lot of the, you know, a lot of the politics of liberation overlaps. A lot of what we can learn from one movement, or our openness to read and be interested in lives that aren't the mainstream or aren't dominant, overlap. So I think what Elaine was doing with Word Power was making sure that those traditions stayed alive. And it worked all in one place. In Scotland, there's one other radical bookshop, Carlton Books, which is a tiny little bookshop in Glasgow. And they have a strong sort of Republican sensibility, a strong connection to Ireland and to Irish independence, and a lot of the sort of Connolly, Ireland-Scotland links. But there, you know, it's like walking into a little radical cupboard, and it's so snug, but it's so full of stuff. And then there's also the wonderful Categories Books, which is an entirely LGBT bookshop that is also in Glasgow's South Side. And I think those are Scotland's radicals. I don't know that there are any others, but that isn't to say that there haven't been.
Well, thanks. And if anyone is listening and is aware of other radical bookshops in Scotland, please email me through thebookshoppodcast.com. And I'd love to know that information. A couple of weeks ago, I interviewed an indie bookshop owner in London. And before we went live, we were chatting about England. And she said, it's a mess over here right now. She went on to explain how people are struggling financially. And like here in the United States, there is a housing shortage, specifically for workers needing to rent near the places they work. And remember, some of those people are working 2 and 3 jobs a week just to support their families. I lived in England during 82, 83, so it was the Thatcher years. Well, it was the Reagan Thatcher years, I guess we could say. So there was a lot of anger and unrest. But I've always loved the UK. At Christmas time, my husband and I visited Ireland, and we fell in love with the people and the culture. And I started to wonder if it was because there's not that feeling of insecurity as there is in the UK at the moment. And a lot of that has to do with them leaving the EU. So tell me how it is in Scotland right now. Is there a rift between Scotland and England? Some of the newspapers are saying that the people of Scotland want to break away from England.
I think a lot of what you're saying really resonates. I think it all, you know, I think a lot of that polarization that is happening in the Western world, but also, you know, we see it in places like India, we see it in Pakistan, we see it, you know, it's that polarization and also that concentration of wealth in more limited hands. And that concentration of resources is inevitable within capitalism. That's the model. If it is unregulated, that is what it's meant to do. And I think the result of that, you know, there are some aspects that we are saved from in the UK that we are so, you know, we have socialized healthcare. We have, you know, our education system isn't as much on its knees as in parts of the US. You know, the ability to get from, you know, birth to death with your basic needs met has been something that you could get through without being bankrupted or, you know, because if you got sick, you could see a doctor. If you needed to educate your kids, if you needed to send them to university, all of these things were and are accessible in theory. But since the Thatcher years, and really it was a response to the very effective organizing against Thatcher, is that successive governments have sort of thought, well, actually the power of the people will stop us from doing the things that we really want to do. Unions are a threat to industry. And, you know, in Scotland, the uprisings against the poll tax meant that, you know, Thatcher couldn't tax the way that she wanted to. And so what we've seen is a slow erosion of the constitution in our country, which is this sort of amorphous mess of official and unofficial, hundreds of years of case law, all of these different things that make up how we build our country. We're losing bits of them. And it has, I think, for a long time, being not happening on the front pages or in a way that's tenuous or we can't reach for. And now it feels very real. You know, now we look at who our elected officials are. We look at, you know, how our country is being run. And we realize that it's really hard for us to hold them accountable. You know, whether it's corruption or lying. And I think that, you know, that is happening in the US as well. I think that's why, in a way, radical bookshops or bookshops like mine are having a renaissance, because I think that we offer two very important things. One of them is, you know, who do you trust? You know, at the moment, we have such an eroded trust in our institutions. We don't trust a lot of the media because we look at the headlines and we go, well, that's not my experience. Or, you know, you're talking about disabled people or people on benefits this way, but that's not anyone that I know. And that separation between what you're seeing on the headlines or in YouTube videos or online and what we know to be true in our bones, the wider that gets, the less we know who to trust. And I think that print media, that idea that by the time a book is printed, which is not to say books are all factually correct, but there's a process involved that means that once you get to the curation, a curated bookshop, and books that have been published that have been through editing and the gatekeeping and all the rest of it, that you feel like you're getting information that slows you down enough to be educated enough to do something. And I think that that's why right now there's a lot of that publishing happening, which means that we have books to sell. And people are interested in reading them because they want something concrete and fact-checked and, you know, with endorsements from people that they trust. And I think the other one is community. I think a big part of radical bookshops, places like Five Leaves, but also places like Housemans and October Books and the new Juno Books in Sheffield, is that we are about that coming together and then doing something with it. And I think at a moment where it feels like, well, what do we do? Like, we're so disempowered by the system. What do you do next? And I feel like there are spaces that are saying, you know, well, it's not over yet. And, you know, we actually can't afford to just surrender and be like, well, nothing's worked so far. We're going to have to find a way to fix it, because all of our lives and the lives of future generations and our capacity just for joy are being eroded by a selfish view. And it's just not good enough.
You're absolutely right. It's just not good enough. And I love what you said about people turning to books endorsed by people they respect. I find it interesting that we're all trying to hold on to our identity. And that might mean that our identity as a country needs to change. It needs to modernize. And with that in mind, thank heavens for radical bookshops like Lighthouse Books.
Thank you. Well, I feel like there's something in books that feeds imagination. And the thing we're going to need is imagination. We're going to have to be able to imagine a future worth fighting for. We're going to have to imagine different ways of organizing. We're going to have to imagine different ways of living, especially, you know, you add on the climate crisis. We just can't keep doing what we're doing. And I think books allow us the space to imagine, whether it's in fiction or nonfiction. And I think those seeds can be so important. They're not the solution. We don't get to read a book on anti-racism and the next day we're an anti-racist. We don't get to, you know, read a sci-fi novel in which we've reimagined gender and somehow a lifetime of being socialized into binary thinking is over. Like, that's not how the books work. But what they do allow us to do is nourish a culture of imagining, of connection, of thinking better. And I think when it comes to especially national identity, in the West, whether it's America, Scotland, England, we have a history that is steeped in waves of oppression of our own people and others. And our sense of greatness, our sense of exceptionalism is anchored in those things. The wealth that allows us to still live the way that we do is anchored in those things. And so I think it does make sense that we are having a moment of identity crisis, where we're sort of like, well, what do we stand for? Are we harking back to something, or are we trying to build something else and building something new out of whatever the best bits of the past were? Is not easy, but some people are, you know, giving us those little flashes of possibility. And for me personally, and I know other people get it from film, other people get it from other kinds of culture, but books for me are one of those slowed down, disconnected, because you're on the page, you're not scrolling, or, you know, it gives you a chance to really connect with ideas in a particular way.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's unfortunate because throughout history, books and writing are often what those in power fear the most. And that's why we're seeing so many banning of books worldwide.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, now talking about writers, I would love to hear about feminist writers in the Edinburgh area. And you also have some fabulous small and medium presses in Edinburgh and in Scotland generally.
We do. There are the bigger ones, and Scotland has a great publishing scene in general, but we are also home to scrappier little independents like 404 Inc., which is still run by two women doing amazing things. And they're the ones who publish these little book called Inklings, of which Emily Garside's book on Schitt's Creek was one of those. They're these sort of pocket-sized essays, like essay plus, and they're great entry books for people who have maybe not a whole an academic book in them, or but they know some about something really well, and then we get this pocket size thing, and they're great. So 404 Inc, Knight Errant Press, they are a little independent queer publisher who have done graphic versions of Tamlin, who have done anthologies of queer writing in Scotland, or from spoken word poets like Ray Crosby. We've got loads of writers, Alison Shaw, Eris Young, the poet Nat Raha, who are based here. The recent winner of the Hugo Awards, Harry Josie Giles, she wrote this extraordinary feminist verse novel, dual language. It was Orcadian and English verse novel space opera that, you know, shouldn't have worked. None of those things are remotely commercial. And yet it won the Hugo Award and it did beautiful things. And Josie's an Edinburgh writer. We have a few. You know, it's always one of those things where as soon as you ask, my mind goes blank.
Yeah, I can relate. Any others come to mind?
Sarah Sheridan, she writes historical fiction, and she is a great feminist writer and sort of passionate about putting women, raising women out of the darkness. So it's not putting them back into history because we were there to start with, but she kind of just resurfaces.
And I'll make sure to put links to all the authors and the presses that you've spoken about in the show notes. Now, Lighthouse gives back to your local community. Was this something you envisioned when you opened the bookshop? And how did this grow during the pandemic?
I think it's inevitable to a certain degree. I think if you curate your shelves so that people who have felt unseen feel seen when they come into your shop or your space, then it connects in a different way where people feel less like you're selling something to them. And they don't have to spend any money, and more like you're saying, well, this is for you. You deserve this. You deserve to be seen, celebrated, your histories, your passions. So I think it is to a certain degree inevitable in a community bookshop that if you actually believe it, it's hard to then say no to the community aspects of things, which means showing up where and when people need you to do that. So for us, a big part of that has been offering a physical space for local groups or for less local groups that need somewhere to either talk about books or to organize, to meet up, to store materials, to take on protests. It's an incredible privilege to have a physical space. And I think because our team, and it is like, it sounds like a royal we, but Lighthouse is the people in it, you know, it's Jim and it's Lindsay and, you know, Peach and Lindsay and Peach and Jim have been with me the longest. And then there's Noor and Rachel and it's just, they're the people that make it and they really care. They care about books and they care about the sort of richness of what's out there and making sure that the people who come and shop with us find those. But they also really care about not seeing people suffering. And so it does mean stopping and having a chat. And if one of our locals who's homeless looks cold, having them in for a cup of tea, it means if there's a protest that is about standing up to hate because people are being hateful to people who are in our community, we are there. It means showing up for things. And I think the result is that people show up for us. So when we've been harassed or when we've been the subject of violence, people have really shown up for us, whether it's letters coming through in support or people saying, I'll show up and not, we'll just be there when you're locking up. So whoever's locking up your shop isn't on their own. And we'll be there when you know. And I think that showing up aspect that is so hard to translate into an online space is the thing that you just have to do it. And we do it. And so people do it with us, for us. Yeah. And I think we never sort of stopped reaching out during the pandemic. A big part of what we do is facilitating for other people the ability to show up. So we have a pay it forward system where people who have some money can stick it on a on a tag in the shop, and it goes online as well. And then people who don't have the money can come in and buy a book, even if they don't have the money. It means that, like, because we'll show up for protests, we're also able to say, this is happening, if anybody else wants to show up, whether that's our newsletter or being the public face of something, if individuals are going to be harassed. So it all kind of feeds into itself. And the last few years have been a shift away from being a bookshop that does activism, and I think into being a community bookshop where books are our vehicle for doing our activism. And I think that's true of quite a few of the bookshops that are on the more radical end that I find really inspiring.
There are two words that you just said that I think are critical at this time in our lives. Showing up, whether it's showing up to vote, whether it's showing up for a friend, whether it's showing up for an event, or to help out a neighbor. I believe that showing up is the precursor to making changes in the world. And when we look at the big picture of the state of the world, it can be overwhelming and depressing. Many tend to forget that we have the power within our communities through voting for local school councils, any form of local government, bringing diverse voices into our local communities, and supporting and nurturing those voices. We need to focus on supporting the systems we live in. And getting back to just show up, local communities are where I believe we can make changes. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this topic. And how do radical bookshops like Lighthouse fit into this equation? You've covered this a little, but is there anything else you'd like to add?
I mean, I think that very much as you're saying, I think caring breeds caring and love breeds love. You know, they are two things that as human beings, we have an unending supply of, but we forget to use them. We forget how powerful those two things can be, to just love, to just care, and what it can, a difference it can make to a person. That simple thing of like, I care enough to stop today. I can't do it every day, but today let's have a cup of coffee, you know, come in and warm up, stop and talk about a book with someone who's so stuck on something sensitive, whether it's, you know, what books, this vulnerability and the experience of saying, you know, I'm looking for a book about trauma. I'm trying to get to the other side of something. And I think those human spaces that allow us to be vulnerable in safe ways help us to see that actually, by and large, a lot of people are going to be kind, and they're going to be understanding, and they're going to step up. And we forget that because online, there are the hyenas and the bots who are always going to have, you know, you're always going to have more of them, because we live in the real world. And if you are made of flesh and bone, then you cannot live in that all the time. And so I think for me, communities and seeing that people care and have the capacity to care, and also being invested so that when bad things happen to people who are a few removed from you, you notice. One of the difficulties we're in right now is that as the majority, you know, and I'm a white, cis, able-bodied, middle-class woman with a college education who grew up traveling the world with a UK passport. I've never struggled getting anywhere. With all the privileges that I have, it took a long time, and it took the spaces like Lighthouse to have friends who were on universal credit and understand how broken our benefit system. It took my sister's disability to see that although we have socialized healthcare, if you don't have a social safety net, people have nothing. And in this country, disabled people have been dying since the Tories took over in 2010 and have been systematically rolling those things back. And so I think neighborhoods as geographic locations are going to be self-selecting, because our geographies are racist and classist. And so I think as much as it is about strengthening those bonds so that we're reminded that people care, and that's a good thing, being able to go that little bit further, or being able to understand that sometimes some things are a zero-sum game. And so you are going to have to make some sacrifices sometimes. Maybe that's not a bad thing. And we can be comfortable with that. And then they don't feel like sacrifices when you see how much of a benefit they can have to the people you care about, or the people you care about who care about. And so I think books allow us to reach out beyond those little spheres. And I hope that going forward, you know, we have a problem with class in this country. In the UK, we have fewer working class creatives in the arts industry than ever before. It's a fragment of what it was in Thatcher's day, because now it's so hard to live, let alone create. So my hope is, if we listen more and make more room for that, then we can sort of strengthen the heart muscles so that we're willing to fight, because sometimes we're going to have to do more than show up and vote on one day of the year. We're going to have to canvas or support people or write to the politicians who are getting it right. When they're getting it right, sending them flowers or postcards and reminding them that they're valued, so that they don't burn out and disappear and get replaced by horrible people. The showing up has to happen all the time.
Mari, I love what you said about remembering to send a thank you note to someone who has worked hard and is feeling burned out. That thank you note can make a difference. It can feed them the energy they need to keep going. I really like that idea. Write thank you notes. Now, do you have a book you'd like to see more people reading? And what are you currently reading?
There's so many.
I know, it's a difficult question.
You must have that every time you ask a bookseller that question.
Yep, without fail, every single time. But some people surprise me. They'll say, absolutely, I'd love everyone to read this book, or I'd like to see more people reading this book. It's interesting to me. My suggestion is to just start with the first one that comes to your mind.
Oh, no, I have so many for so many different people. Will you allow me three?
Yes, of course. Three is grand.
So one of them is the writer Lola Olufemi, who is a young Black feminist out of London. And she's written two books. One is Feminism Interrupted. And the other one is on imagination. And she writes like a poet. And she is fierce in a way that is very Audre Lorde. There is a sort of a very centered, very loving reaching out in the way that she is galvanizing. So reading Lola Olufemi, everyone should read more of her. And she's published by two great radical presses, Pluto Press and Hajar Press. So supporting small publishers doing cool things. The other one is an American writer who is published by AK Press, who's Cindy Milstein. And she has written two books on grief, Radical Mourning, and I think the other one is There Is Nothing So Whole as a Broken Heart. And both of them come out of a radical anarchist Jewish tradition looking at collective grief and about mourning. And I think post-COVID, I think we are in for a reckoning for the thousands of lives that have been lost that we have not had a chance to make time to just acknowledge what that does to a country. How many families are grieving alone, being gaslit into thinking that this absolutely catastrophic few years is just something we all need to move on from. And I think Cindy Milstein, and these are edited collections that have loads of wonderful contributors. And I think they have a lot to teach us for the power and potential and necessity of grieving properly. And the last one, I would say it's because I'm reading it at the moment, is a book by Pete Warmby called Untypical, which is about autism and what the neurotypical among us can do to make the world just more navigable for our autistic and neurodivergent friends, families, you know. And it's clever and it's fun and it's full of so many simple adaptations that we can all make in the way that we walk through life. And I think if more people read it, we would stop so much unnecessary suffering without really having to do all that much. So yeah, those are my three.
That's fascinating. And you know what? It covers your currently reading too.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, before we started the interview, you and I were talking about a book which I had just purchased. one that I heard one of my sons talking about. And then when I went to buy it at Bart's Books here in Ojai, the young girl said, "Oh, this is a great book. Everyone should read this book." The name of the book is Caliban and the Witch: Women, the Body and Primitive Accumulation by Sylvia Federici.
Yes, Sylvia Federici.
So let's talk about this fabulous book.
I mean, the book is a classic. And I think she's only just being published by Penguin in the UK. So we've had to import her books from the US from PM Press for a while, which makes them a little less affordable to the average reader. So it's great to have Caliban and the Witch now super affordable. But she is a titan of feminist literature, and she has a way of connecting the personal with the political, and about talking unapologetically about the sort of mechanisms of capitalism and the way we embody them in patriarchy, that is brilliant. And I think she has also become more accessible. I think if you know nothing about any of those things, then you're like, okay, well, that's a lot of jargon. Those are a lot of words that sound, you know, she is academic. They are meaty books, but they are accessible in that they're intended to invite the reader in and empower the reader, I think. And when I met her a few years ago, she came and did an event in the shop, and she is tiny. She is the tiniest little lady. And she is so fierce. And it was sort of this reminder that power comes in so many different packages. And I thought, the world must have always underestimated you, you know, because she looks so unobtrusive. And I think also the reminder, and in the writing she's doing now, you know, older women are so dismissed by society. But you're reading it, you're enjoying it.
Oh, yeah, I'm loving it. It's right up my alley. Mari, it's been great chatting with you. I think we could chat for a long, long time. Thank you for all you're doing to make the world a better place, a kinder place. And I look forward to chatting with you again.
And you. You have to get yourself to Edinburgh now.
Yes, I do. It's definitely on my bucket list. And I would actually really like to be there for the Fringe. You're a part of that, right?
Yes. So Edinburgh sort of explodes with festivals in August, and we run a book fringe to the Fringe Festival right through August. And then we have our own big festival, our Radical Book Fair, in November. And this year, we haven't even announced it yet, but we are running Scotland's first romance festival. We're doing a festival in June called First Date, because romance is radical. Enough of dead women in car boots with all the crime. Nothing more feminist than women getting a happy ending, in my opinion.
I couldn't agree more.
More happy ending.
Yes, absolutely. Let's do this again soon, Mari. It's been fun.
Thank you very much. I've been enjoying discovering your podcast.
You've been listening to my conversation with Mari Oliver from Lighthouse Books in Edinburgh. To find out more about the Bookshop Podcast, go to thebookshoppodcast.com and make sure to subscribe and leave a review wherever you listen to the show. You can also follow me at Mandy Jackson Beverly and the Bookshop Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, and on YouTube at the Bookshop Podcast. If you have a favorite indie bookshop that you'd like to suggest we have on the podcast, I'd love to hear from you via the contact form at thebookshoppodcast.com. The Bookshop Podcast is written and produced by me, Mandy Jackson Beverly. Theme music provided by Brian Beverly. Executive assistant to Mandy, Adrian Otterhan, and graphic design by Francis Farala. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.